Welcome everybody to the Aris Meyer podcast. How are you doing today? I have with me a really cool guest that I have known over, I would say, maybe 20 years, and a guest that I have met maybe two times in person, but is a lovely human being that I'd like the world to meet. Her name is Jen Chiaba. How are you doing, Jen?
I'm doing great. Thanks so much for having me. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm currently in my grandma's bedroom, as you can see, visiting my family. So this is quite an adventure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, surrounded by clown dolls, I see.
Yep, clown dolls and tchotchkes. It's very strange. So Jen, tell me a little bit about you. Where did you grow up? Your family, where'd you go to school?
Well, I kind of grew up all over the place. I was born in Queens, New York, and my mother moved me to the Phoenix, Arizona area when I was a baby. My sister was born there, and my family stayed there till I was probably about three. And then we moved to the Northern Virginia area. And then when I was probably five, we moved to Charlottesville, Virginia.
Jeez.
And I was there until I was 12, and then we moved back to Phoenix, and we moved all over Phoenix. And then when I was 15, we moved to Bridgeport, Connecticut. And then after that, I ended up here in the Hudson Valley, New York. So sort of full circle.
You have lived everywhere. That's like that Johnny Cash song. I've been everywhere.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Why did you live in so many places? Did your parents have like an interesting job or?
Well, so my father worked for the Unification Church, that's where you and I met. We both mm-hmm. grew up in the church. I was born into it, and you were brought in very young, as I understand. Mm-hmm. So both of my parents, when they joined the church, they left their college educations behind. And unlike many church members, they actually both finished their educations while they were in the church. My mom went to the University of Hawaii and got her bachelor's in Spanish because she was born in Mexico. So it was sort of, I wouldn't say it was her first language, but she was born to expats in Mexico and was raised by Mexican nannies. So it was certainly a language that she learned very young. And she was working for one of the many church front groups at the time that she was in her, I guess, mid to late 20s. And there was a lot of work being done in Central and South America. And so I guess she figured that she could use the Spanish language as part of furthering what the church would call the providence.
Mm-hmm.
But when we were living in Arizona, when I was a baby, my mom had gotten her degree, but my father was basically selling flowers on a roadside stand or at a roadside stand to support us.
Yeah.
And my mom, I guess, had like sort of this come to Jesus talk, if you will, with my dad. They decided that in order for him to really have a better mission, or just I guess even like a mission period in the church, he should go back to school. So he went to ASU for his undergrad and then Georgetown for his master's, which is what brought us across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the church offered him a job in DC too after he got his undergrad. But there's a lot of haziness around it. Like in the family folklore, it was like he was offered this job. And when he showed up, they said, actually, the salary is going to be 1/3 of what we really offered you.
Oh, wow. Classic church business.
I know. So anyway, he got his master's at Georgetown. And then he went for his PhD at the University of Virginia. And so his focus was political science, specifically international relations with North Korea, because in the church, the reunification of North and South Korea was considered to be very high priority. And so there was think tanks dedicated to that and whatnot. And that was sort of the mission that my dad was striving for. So after that, it was more like familial chaos as my family unraveled that put us around the country again. But in those early years, we were more dedicated towards that academic mission, if you will.
Yeah. You mentioned a lot of places. When your mom went to school, did you get to go to Hawaii or was it like online school?
So my mom went in 81. So it was before I was born, before she was.
That sucks.
Yeah. I've never been to Hawaii, unfortunately.
Of all the places that you could have lived.
I know. It sounded beautiful. I've seen pictures. But yeah, that was not one place I got to live.
Wow. So you hopped around schools then, or were you mostly homeschooled, or did you like kind of?
I did a little bit of both. I think I went to 11 schools in 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so to kind of dive a little bit into some of the church logistics, you know, we sort of, unless you were in like a very populationally dense area with a lot of church members, there wasn't a lot of infrastructure for us. Mm-hmm. You know, like when we were in Charlottesville, we were 2 hours away from the closest church member. So those were pretty formative years for me between like 5 and 12. And so I was kind of isolated going to public school, and my family was not a healthy family. So I dropped out of school halfway through seventh grade and homeschooled, which was basically me being left to my own devices, like reading encyclopedias, because my family couldn't afford a homeschool curriculum. And my parents just weren't that invested in anything that wasn't church related. And so in eighth grade, I was in Arizona, and I also dropped out of school halfway through, and same thing, just sort of like farted around with encyclopedias. And then for 10th grade, same thing, you know, cause we had moved again. Wow. And it was just starting over so many times was difficult. Plus, you know, my mom really emphasized to me that like my identity as a second generation church member, we called it being a blessed child, was supposed to be like my secret identity unless I was with church members. And so mm-hmm. I grew up with this sense of having to hide myself for many years. And that's really hard to keep up as a kid. And so it kind of created a lot of fracture within me. So I not only like this uprooting every 9 months or a year, but then, you know, not being able to like be myself meant that school sucked.
Yeah, it must have been really, I mean, being the new kid is like,
the worst.
Yeah. Always. Everyone always has like their groups of friends and their cliques. And like, I don't know what it's like being a young lady, obviously, but I know like for dudes, if you're the new kid, you're getting picked on almost straight away. And I don't know if for girls, it's like even worse, but.
The only times I've ever been picked on was in sixth grade. There were these two girls that were at my bus stop. They were seventh graders, and because I was in sixth grade, they bullied me all year on the bus.
Ooh.
But then like, so the first day of seventh grade, I get on the bus and I was like, what? So are you going to bully me again today? And they're like, no, you're in seventh grade now. It's fine. Now it's your turn to bully somebody else.
You stepped up.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was a sassy little child. But I was actually never bullied as much going to school as I was when I went to a church boarding school for a year.
Wow.
So that says something about some of the culture that we were indoctrinated into.
Yeah, 100%. I met you on a summer youth program, probably, I think we were both in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, it was basically, it was called Pure Love Alliance. And it was basically our religion teaches like a very puritanical, kind of Christian purity culture where we're taught, you know, that we should save ourselves, be abstinent before marriage, and that we should be, you know, have fidelity in marriage, we should stay together, build like the family unit. So our church had like this huge summer program where like hundreds of kids would get together, and we would do like straight up rallies through different cities where we had like placards and chants and dances. It's funny because I see people that are trying to affect real change, like Black Lives Matter, that are doing a similar kind of thing. Yeah. And then I think back on what we were doing, and it was like, just makes me like my skin crawl a little bit, like kind of like preaching and like,
One of the unfortunate sort of side effects of doing that for several summers is that I really struggle in like a rally environment. And marches, you know, like as much as I support Black Lives Matter, like being out there in the street is so triggering for me.
I can imagine.
So, yeah. And I don't know if everybody that like did Pure Love Alliance with us experiences the same thing. When you and I met, it was a very traumatic time in my life. And so I think I associate Pure Love Alliance with that. Mm-hmm. So it's probably linked in that way. But yeah, like there's definitely a lot of things that I really support people affecting change that are literally in the streets but the stuff that we were doing.
We were like 15 and like telling people not to have sex before marriage. And like, what do we know? We weren't dating. We weren't, you know, we didn't know like what we were talking about. And it's like so cringy to think back that like people are walking by. And if they would have challenged us in any way, we would have been like,
I did have a woman, I don't know if it was on PLA 99 or PLA 2000, like I was handing out leaflets or something. And she goes, well, how will I know if a man will beat me or not, unless I like sleep with him? And I was like, so first of all, to be asking like a 14-year-old that question, like, how do you expect somebody to give a response?
Yeah, that's heavy as shit.
Yeah, I was just like, shit, I don't know. Sit down. Let's talk about this. Like, how do you know? Because because I didn't really grow up in a church community, and the first time that I had like serious contact with the church community was when I moved to Arizona when I was 12. Like, I kind of thought church people were weird. And so I wasn't necessarily 100% on board with like all the stuff that we were doing on PLA and everything. So like when this person, she wasn't even necessarily challenging me, she was just like asking a legitimate question. I was like, I don't know, let's talk about this. And then the leader comes up and is like snapping at me like, no, you get up, you keep going, hand out those leaflets and fundraise and whatnot.
But
I wanted to have conversation because I didn't know. We were just being told like what to spout from these curriculums that we were given. And I had no defense whatsoever against like honest to God, real life questions and concerns.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, straight up indoctrination. But yeah, I remember meeting you because there was like a curriculum that we followed. There's very specific things we did every day. And somehow, I think you and I had done, there was like a speech contest and we had both given speeches, and they like knew that we were like eloquent, and somehow there was like a, maybe you remember better than me, there was like a poetry night at like in a local town, and they wanted to send representatives. Yeah. In Philadelphia. Yeah. And they wanted to send representatives. So they sent you and I and another person. And I think we had like met briefly before that, but I don't remember why they sent us, but me and you were like, we both wrote poems. And I guess I don't remember if we had volunteered, but that's like when I had met you for the first time, when we actually had some kind of like rapport. Do you remember that?
I do, except I remember meeting you a little bit before that. And it was when you and me and a group of other sisters, as we called them, and then your like blood brother, we were sitting in a park on a sidewalk, like maybe before a rally or something. And we were talking about like our favorite movies. And I was super intimidated by you because like you present as a real tough guy. And so like I didn't really want to talk to you. Until you're like, yeah, my favorite movie is Cinderella. I like the mice. And then I was like, oh, this dude is a softy. And then I was like, okay, I like this person. And so I had that interaction with you before the poetry slam. But yeah, that was definitely, that night in Philly was definitely more of like a moment of connection, because I think, I don't remember exactly the poem that you presented, but the one that I presented was about a dysfunctional relationship with my father. And that's the kind of stuff that like, we weren't really allowed to talk about that in the church. Like, you presented a happy face. And so to be vulnerable like that, and I'm pretty sure like what you were presenting was equally as vulnerable and just like showing us as these flawed beings that were struggling with identity and just growing up, period, you know, like all adolescent struggles, you really weren't allowed to like go through that in the church. And so it was a rare moment of real connection for me in the church. That's definitely something that stands out.
Yeah, that's how I felt too. My dad joined the church when I was in middle school. And before that, I had grown up with just my dad. I didn't really have a relationship with my mom. She kind of chose like the party life over me and my brother Jove. She was always out drinking and partying and, you know, like basically just having sex with other dudes. I mean, she had like her own life. So, the way that I grew up was kind of like low self-esteem, not really feeling value and love. So I was really like, I had been writing poems and stuff since a pretty young age, and that was like my outlet to describe, you know, like just, you know, trying to kind of like get some of the stuff inside of me out. So when like you said, when we were growing up in the church, we were told to always present the positive for sure. So I didn't really have, I didn't really know people's pains and struggles very much. Like it seemed like as like kind of as an outsider that everyone had their perfect family and that everyone was very happy and on a path to like a happy marriage one day or relationship. So when we were on PLA and we got that opportunity and we went to the poetry night and you like said your poem, I was like, holy shit. Like this person has a hard life like me. Like they have, you know, a situation with their family like I do. And they also write poems. So it was like an instant connection for me where I was like, oh, like this is a special person.
Yeah.
Cause you don't get to see that in people, or at least I hadn't to that point. So I remember after that being like, oh, I really want to be around this person because she's authentic. Mm-hmm. And you know, like, not everyone writes poems, and there's a lot of, stereotypes about people that write poems. You know what I mean? it's not like the coolest thing. You know what I mean? Like maybe back in the day, it would have been really cool, but, I was just like, man, she's really special. So after that, I feel like is when we became friends. My mind.
No, definitely. That was the starting point for me too. And I mean, as you mentioned, we've met in person IRL twice that we can both remember, but I remember having like a very strong online friendship.
Yep.
And I think that was something that a lot of us in the church and maybe people who are outside the church can relate to this too, but like there is such a immediacy and intimacy to talking to somebody on the internet. Like we were using AIM back in the day. And the stuff that we were talking about was like completely forbidden and not, you know, to be clear, we weren't like sexting or anything.
Yeah. Like it wasn't like that. No.
You know, like we were sharing struggles and we were talking about real life stuff and it was stuff that was not allowed. Those were things that, you know, would have been completely squashed in conversation in church circles. And so to find those people and to have those authentic conversations for me, they were such a lifeline.
Yeah. Same for me. And I think it's, like my family is very dysfunctional. So it was almost therapy to go online. And, you know, I had met so many people on these big church retreats that were like nationwide, people from all over the East Coast and the Midwest. And the only way to connect with them was online. Yeah. And I didn't even have a computer at home. Like I would go to the library and use like the free computer and, you know, but it was almost for me in my life, it was like being drowning a little bit, and it was fresh air to get an email or have an AIM conversation with somebody where you could really like vent. And that's the kind of relationship I felt like we had. But when did you start writing poems? When did that start for you?
Well, I remember the first time that my poems were found by my mother. I was 12 and she confronted me about them. I might have been writing them earlier, but that's something that sticks out in my mind because I remember like I used the phrase and please, you know, laugh because it's terrible, but I was 12, something along the lines of like turning your face to the black sun, you know, and my mother was like horrified.
Yeah.
And she's like, what is this about? And I had found out that a pen pal of mine who was a church member had like started doing drugs. And so I was like, oh, it's about that. You know, it's about like me feeling sorry for her. It totally wasn't. It was just me lying. So I didn't get in trouble. So I might have been writing earlier than that. But again, you know, it's like that traumatic moment that sticks out in my mind.
Yeah, I feel you. My dad found my poems a couple times. And I think that on some level, like he would read them and like mock me almost. He'd be like, oh, poor you, your life is so hard.
Oh yeah.
And it's like, it was like borderline abuse, like emotional abuse. You know what I mean? Cause I think that by reading those, he almost felt like attacked, like, I didn't give you a good enough life. You know, you're so sad.
Yeah.
So I hid a lot of that stuff from him and my family. But it was just cool to find people that had, you know, an artistic outlet, kind of like I did. So after that, I think, the majority of our friendship was online. We would like write each other. One thing that I remember about you specifically is that you were very into Shakespeare.
Tell
me about your relationship with Shakespeare.
It started when I was 10 and he was what, 500? No.
Pretty illegal.
Right. The first time I ever did a Shakespeare play was when I was in fifth grade. It was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and I was cast as Titania. It was part of something called the Core Club, which was like the gifted program. And we would get pulled out of class to, you know, do all kinds of stuff like dissect starfish and, you know, do weird nerdy kid stuff. And so one of the things that we did was this play. Mm-hmm. And I remember falling in love with the language. And also just like, it was so madcap, that particular play, that it was hilarious. And learning about culture that way and these various dynamics, I just fell in love with it. And so the last play that I did actually before my fiance and I bought this house was also A Midsummer Night's Dream 10 years ago. So yeah, I've bookended my relationship with Shakespeare that way, but I've always continued to love those words, his poetry, his plays, his prose, as a lens into human nature and the human experience. And I think that it was a really interesting counterpoint for me growing up in the church, because there were so many limitations in our life in the church, you know, and there was so much in terms of like what we couldn't experience, what we couldn't feel or express. And there's so much in his plays that still to this day are grappling with topics that we're uncomfortable with, you know, about sexuality and gender and identity and life and death and what does it all mean. Yeah. And politics too, you know, that it's his plays, that's why they're still relevant today. Now, I mean, there's the whole authorship question that we won't get into, obviously. Yeah. But you know, whoever wrote them, whatever collective or person wrote them, I think that they're such a beautiful lens into our human experience, and I've just never stopped loving them.
Yeah, I feel like when I was younger, you know, I also did drama. For me, it was like a very big escape to do mm-hmm. theater mm-hmm. because you could kind of be free and breathe. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, for me, I could like talk to girls and like, you know what I mean? Like have some kind of semblance of romance and normalcy.
Right.
But I know that you also did drama growing up, right? Uh-huh. You were a drama kid.
Much to my mother's chagrin, my sister and I first started doing community theater when I was 8 and she was 6. We did a production of Aladdin. And
who are you? I gotta know.
We were just like jewels in this cave. So in the play,
is that the same as being the tree in the background?
Probably, yeah. We were like singing trees in the background. Originally, it was like there was rubies and sapphires and emeralds or something, and rubies were on like stage right and sapphires were on stage left. And originally we were both on the same side of the stage, and we fought so much that the director had to separate us and like turn us into different jewels.
Yeah.
And like I think I did Meet Me in St. Louis, and we did Annie, and we were orphans in Annie, and we were supposed to do like choreographed stage fighting, but we just like mostly beat each other up on stage.
Like the real deal stuff.
Oh yeah. We fought a lot growing up, but for us too, it was like theater was community, and we didn't have community in those days because again, we were so far away from other church members and we were so isolated in the life that our parents wanted us to live. We went to church in DC on the holy days. So there was like 8 of them on the church calendar at that point because mm-hmm. my parents didn't want to drive 2 hours each way with 5 kids in the car.
Yeah.
You know, like every Sunday. That's
yeah. Just, who could blame them?
No, that's torture. And you know, we didn't have the money, frankly, gas wise for that trip, and the wear and tear it would have done on our van would have been terrible. So yeah, it was really a way for me and my sister to find community and explore identity. And interestingly, you know, we weren't allowed to do sex ed as many kids in the church were not.
Nope, we absolutely were not.
No, but it was, for me, it was an introduction into human sexuality. And I don't mean that in an alarming way, but like, I learned about like our bodies because this girl like showed me this book that her
mother
had given her. Yeah. And she said something. I remember saying to her, she might've been like a few years older than me, but I was 8 or 9 at the time. And I remember being like, well, I'm never having sex because that's evil, because that's what we were taught. Just straight up sex is evil.
Yeah. The worst.
Don't you want to have babies? And I was like, yeah, duh. And she's like, okay, let me show you my book.
Oh, and my
God.
Like,
oh, my God. I was horrified. But of course, because sex was like such an evil thing, I couldn't come to my parents and be like, all right, I've got this conundrum.
Yeah.
But yeah, like the theater became the community that like educated and raised me in certain regards, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Sex ed was, I never got to do sex ed. And I remember as a little boy, just being so totally confused when mm-hmm. it came to anything related to like, especially the female body, obviously the male body, I had one, so I could kind of figure it out, but right. like just being a kid and being totally ignorant and being like, what does a girl have that a boy does? I had no idea for the longest time because we couldn't do sex ed. We couldn't do like normal things. And then you end up finding, like, you end up learning about it from like other kids. So everything that you learn is like super dumb and like you know, the kids' ideas. But yeah, drama was important to me too. I remember the first play I was ever in was an all white version of The Wiz. That was like my middle school was like pretty much all white. And we did The Wiz, which is, I don't know whose idea that was, but I remember I was like the main henchman, the main bad guy. And my big scene was like, I had to kiss the witch's foot. At some point, like, I forget why it was like
that's some contact there.
It was some contact. And I got, you know, I had some conversations after that. But I loved theater. So through high school, I kept doing it. And I just really, what I liked about theater was everyone there was like, you have all different walks of life mm-hmm. behind that stage. Mm-hmm. And growing up, I guess, fundamentalist as we did, and I've talked, you know, I talked about this on my last podcast with my brother,
yeah.
you know, gay people were viewed in a very specific way. Yeah. Trans people weren't even talked about. They were just joked about.
They were invisible. They were invisible as far as I knew. Yeah.
So being in theater, I mean, I really got to meet all kinds of people. And mm-hmm. I really thought that was lovely because it's a very vulnerable thing. And I really enjoyed, I mean, one, just like standing in front of an audience because I was like an invisible kid, you know, no one. I grew up really poor. No one really was watching me. You know, I was wandering the streets by myself. And then two, to bring it back to Shakespeare, just being able to like express yourself and the deepest like feelings that you have through someone else's words. Mm-hmm. That's what made Shakespeare powerful to me is mm-hmm. I could say things that I felt and he put them into words and like saying those words was like powerful to me.
Yeah.
My biggest moment, of course, and then we'll change the topic, but I got to bring this up. In 11th grade, I got to be Gaston in Beauty and the Beast. And that was like, I was over the moon because I grew up watching, you know, Disney movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And my dad's French. And I was just like, yo, I was born to play mm-hmm. Gaston. And I remember we were in drama class and the teacher was like assigning the parts. And she was like, Aris, do you think that you could be Gaston? And like, without skipping a beat, I was like, I started singing like some of the songs from the movie. And she was like, she was so happy. So that was like my big moment, like getting to be Gaston.
I mean, and that part, to be clear, is like, so not you. It shows your acting ability because like when you say you're born to play that part, like this misogynistic bully, like that is so not even, you. No, I know.
I'm saying
that speaks to your versatility that you can kind of like go there and put on somebody that is so not you who stands for things that you are so not for, you know?
But that's the magic of theater, right? Yeah, is like getting to be all these different human beings. Like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. yeah. And also, I mean, to be honest, like his songs are pretty great.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
That's really what I was excited about was to like sing those songs.
He's a very charismatic villain. It's funny though, because my fiance's dream role is LeFou. I think he might have actually played that role too.
Oh my God. I am coming over and we are going to do a full production.
Okay.
That is incredible. Oh my God. I'm so happy. Okay. So to switch gears, the thing that I've been really inspired by that you've been doing the last couple years, and you can tell me how you came to this place, is you're an incredible artist.
Thank you.
And I never actually knew you were an artist when we were younger. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I knew you from online discussions about our family and about current events, about the church, and just kind of keeping up with each other's lives. I knew that you wrote poems. I knew that you were into theater. But I remember the first time I saw your art, and I don't remember how long ago it was because I'm really terrible with time. It was so striking to me, because it's a very specific, like your message to me was very specific, very raw, very mm-hmm. powerful, and very straightforward. And because I knew your life, and maybe you can share a little bit about what inspired it, it was particularly moving to me. So if you'd like, if you can describe your art a little bit and then kind of your influence.
Yeah. I mean, so my art is photo-based, mostly self-portraiture, and it's really exploring the female experience of growing up at the church. I was forced into an arranged marriage and spent 2 years trying to escape it, and an arranged marriage to a stranger too. And that was sort of my breaking point with the church, because in the church theology, to have sex before or outside of the blessing arranged marriage mass wedding ceremony was like the greatest sin. But then to break the blessing, as we called it, was probably like right up there with falling. Oh,
yeah. The worst.
And so I was basically like, people stopped talking to me once they knew that I was struggling, period. But then when I, you know, finally made that break, I was out, you know. Mm-hmm. Even though I think like if the church had been more accepting of me and my struggles, I probably would have tried to stay. Like I never really jived with the church, but at the same time, like did everything that I could to be, and I think you can relate to this, to like be the good church kid, to be uh-huh. accepted,
yep.
To put on the identity that we thought would get us love and acceptance.
100%. I mean, I wanted to date, I wanted to kiss girls, I wanted, you know, but I didn't do it because, that's the, you know, yeah, I think everyone did, but you know, right. you put on airs because that's what the church, that's how you were a good kid in the church.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think you and I both experienced being kind of targeted by leadership as mouthpieces because they found out that we had the ability to speak in front of crowds. So I was mm-hmm. in PLA 99 and PLA 2000. I was put up there to give speeches as sort of part of like this PR team. And I remember writing in my journal, like, okay, so I'm this kid that like goes up there and gives these speeches about abstinence, but I don't know if I believe that.
Yeah.
You know,
they also, they liked our, we had traumatic stories too. And I think that that's what they wanted, like to sensationalize and like use our brokenness to like make their message more, I'm blanking on the word, but they knew that our stories were powerful. So they were like, you guys can get up there and really sell it. Like,
well, I didn't share my traumatic story. My traumatic story was very much a family secret. But I think for you, because you were brought into the church, your family trauma could have been used as like a redemption story. Like, see, look, they went through these things and look at how great they are now.
Yeah, totally.
Whereas my family was completely falling apart at that time when you and I met. So it was not something for public consumption because... It was the kind of thing where like, if people found out, I would have been exiled from the church at a much younger age. Mm. But to sort of bring it back to art. So, I mean, my grandmother on my mom's side was a painter. My dad's dad was a comic artist and my mom's dad was a photographer. So there's sort of like art in the blood. But the art that my sister and I were allowed to make was the happy paintings of, you know, landscapes and whatnot. So I had like, much like my poetry, secret sketchbooks and whatnot, where like, just to give you a visual, like I have this sketch that I did, I think it was when I was in New Eden. So I was 16 at a church boarding school. It's a girl in this torn white dress, like standing there in the rain, but the rain is blood and it's, you know, dripping down this, the slit wrist of this giant hand. And so she's like standing in a puddle of blood. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of other drawings like that. And if you had asked me at 16, like, what is this about? I couldn't have told you. But I think that for me, it was really this subconscious manifestation of the sexual violence that was committed in the church via purity culture. Hmm. The ways in which, and I know that, you know, everybody experienced this on various levels, but women particularly were demonized in the church. And I also didn't have the language for it back then, but the idea of So women were supposed to be submissive in the church. In the church, the language was man as subject, woman as object. And it really meant like complete submission as a woman. So this idea that you had to save yourself for this stranger someday to then basically own your body. Like Reverend Moon talked about how your spouse would be the owner of your sexual organ. I never really fully understood it until I got married and there's this stranger now demanding submission from me.
Jesus.
Like the violence of that. And of course, you know, I was one of the lucky ones in that I fought my way out and didn't experience the trauma, the full trauma of what that submission would look like. But even still, I had all kinds of nightmares of being raped during those years. And there are studies that are now kind of coming to light. And there's a book called Pure. I believe the author's name is Lindsay K. Klein. I have it on my bookshelf. I could grab it to double check. But in it, she talks about how the subset of society that she studies is the white female evangelical experience within purity culture. But I think that this exists in a much broader spectrum. But in this particular subset, the trauma of purity culture manifests the same way as the trauma of sexual assault and sexual violence. Wow. And so really that is the core of my work. It's the broader body of work is called Burdens of a White Dress, and it explores sort of the psychological landscape of being forced into this relationship with a stranger and then them basically saying, like, you know, they need to have access to every part of you, you know, mm-hmm. mentally, emotionally, physically. And not that they were, this person was a bad person. That was just what we were all brought up to believe.
Yeah.
And so this sense of I'm a bad person because I don't want to subject myself to that experience, that sort of threads in there as well. And so I started creating work like this, like I said, when I was 15, 16, and I hid these sketchbooks for many years. And even when I was in college, I was kind of creating paintings like this too. But it wasn't until Moon died that I think I felt safe creating the work. And so the first pieces in that particular body of work were created in 2012. And it's been sort of this ongoing project. And I use it to speak to my experience, but also to connect to other survivors, because there is so much intersection between various survivors. So survivors of domestic violence, survivors of cultic abuse, survivors of child and forced arranged marriage. There are so many people who can kind of relate to some of these experiences. And so, you know, when I give artists talks or when I partner with nonprofits, those are kind of the key things that I look for, is like really speaking to the resiliency of survivors, survivors' rights, trying to shed light on like what coercive control looks like at various levels. So within the cultic experience, within a familial experience, within a political experience, or even in a one-on-one relationship in domestic violence. So like I use my story as a lens, which is again why I do self-portraiture. And I usually create with a very limited palette. I create with black, white, red, and then, you know, my flesh tones in there, mostly because red was this like this color of Satan, you know, and fallen mm-hmm. women, at least as far as my mother was concerned. Like I wasn't allowed to wear red growing
really?
Up. Really? Yeah. I remember I'd left the church. I was living on my own and I bought this red coat and I was too scared to wear it for a long time because it just felt so like flagrant to me, you know?
That's so crazy.
Yeah. And you know, now like it's one of my favorite colors. I have a red car.
Yeah. The second time I ever met you, you were wearing a red coat.
I was, that's the red coat. Yeah. That's a red coat.
You wore the red coat when you met me?
I wore the red coat.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So fallen.
I know. But yeah, so, you know, black and white as this, obviously to kind of highlight the fact that like, you know, there is a lot of black and white thinking in these relationships, in these various structures. but also to, again, highlight the red that I'm using, you know, because that's really the focus for me. It was like, red is this color that is associated with femininity, with blood, with shame, with sin. And so when I have people look at these photographs, you know, if they haven't had the experiences that might lend themselves to like really understanding the work on a visceral level, then I do want them to like look at the color palette and start to ask these questions about like, okay, what does black and white and red say to me? What does a woman dressed in white say to me? What does a woman dressed in red say to me? And those are the kinds of things that I want people to confront if they don't see themselves in the work. Does that make sense?
It does, absolutely. And I was actually gonna ask you about the color palettes because it's something that I had noticed.
Yeah.
To me, it's striking because, I mean, on two levels. One, because I know you personally and I know your story, so I can see kind of the base inspiration for it. But just as a human being, I mean, to me, it's very obviously something that people can relate to just on an emotional gut level. I mean, when you see those images, and you know, I'm a heterosexual straight white male, they're not made for me, but when I see them, I feel the vulnerability. And it makes me sit back and process my own interactions with, you know, sexuality, with vulnerability, with shame, with even violence. Mm-hmm. So it speaks, it's very loud. It's quiet and loud at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I really encourage people to check out your work, because I think especially for anyone in America, like America is, it's a puritanical culture and a hypersexualized culture at the same time. It's almost like, unless you're one of the two extremes, then you're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. But I feel like your work highlights the underlying undercurrent of abuse, especially towards women in this country. So it's very powerful. And I know that recently I've been seeing that you've been connecting your work a lot with child brides. And yeah. Tell me about that a little bit.
So I don't remember exactly how I got in touch with this organization, but there's a nonprofit called Unchained at Last, and they work to help pass legislation in the United States to outlaw child marriage because it's currently legal in 46 states. Now, I was not a child bride. Mm-hmm. However, there are a number of people that we grew up with that were, because kids were married off as young as 16. Reverend Moon said that as soon as children were adolescents and able to basically conceive of like sexuality, they needed to be married. Now, maybe he realized that in America, marrying kids off at 12 wasn't cool.
Yeah, but not into it.
I think if he had his way, we would have all have been, you know, married off very, very young.
Probably like in middle school, I would imagine. I mean, when you start having those ideas and feelings.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the culture that we come from. But Unchained at Last also helps women out of forced arranged marriages. And so that's where I connected with them. And I created an image for them for their 2014 annual fundraiser for an auction. And since then, I've partnered with them in various capacities. I've mentored other women who have come out of forced arranged marriages in the Unification Church. And this year, well, not in 2021, but in 2020, I partnered with them in a licensing agreement for them to use 12 of my images to help promote their campaigns. Wow. And then this year I partnered with the Resiliency Foundation, which has a similar mission. And, you know, both of the founders have very different experiences. Both of them were married off, I believe, underage. One was married in a very Orthodox Jewish environment, and another one was married in, I think, a completely secular environment. So these women are both working towards this same end of protecting children from a lot of violence and a lot of really bad outcomes that happen when young women specifically are married underage. And it's very interesting to see how much pushback they get from politicians. If you watch A&E's I Was a Child Bride on Hulu right now, the conversations that some of the politicians have about why they don't want to pass these laws are pretty eye-opening, to say the least.
Yeah, it's insane to me how religion is used to like almost circumvent morality. I mean, common sense morality.
Well, and what's interesting is that most of the stories that are highlighted in this particular documentary don't have anything to do with religion. It's
really
young girls being raped and then married to their rapists so that their rapists don't go to jail.
Yeah. What?
Yeah. So in the secular world, there is some shit going down too. And these laws are really put in place to protect young women from becoming victims and being married to their abusers.
Wow. That's so crazy.
Yeah. But I totally agree with you that religion is often used as this shield, you know?
Yeah.
And we see it, you know, in some of the things coming out in the Catholic Church for sure. But I don't think any of that surprises us given the culture that we were raised in.
Yeah. For us, it's crazy how I have this ability to like look at things like that and go, oh, I could see where they're coming from. But not that I agree with it or condone it in any way. But it's like I can see how a person would get to that place in their life where they accept those things and they just think this is what it is. This is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if people want to find your work or they want to connect with that organization, where should they go?
Well, my work is at jenkiaba.com. So JenKiaba.com. And you can find me on Facebook and Instagram under Jen Kiaba. If you want to connect with Unchained at Last, then you can just go to unchainedatlast.com. The other organization that I'm working with is the Resiliency Foundation, and I believe they are resiliencyfoundation.com, but they could be .org. So maybe I can give you that information to put in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure. And anyone, definitely feel free to Google, connect with Jennifer or connect with myself. All right, it is time for the lightning round.
Uh-oh.
Are you ready?
No.
Are you ready for the lightning round? I know that was a very heavy topic. Everybody that was listening, take a deep breath. We're switching it up a little bit with the random questions to finish out this podcast. All right, we'll give you a softball at first. What is your go-to karaoke song?
I don't even know. I haven't done karaoke in like 15 years.
Really?
Yeah, the last time I did karaoke, I was in the church. We did norebang in Korea, and I couldn't tell you.
Okay. Let me change it up. Okay. You're in your car, and you want to put yourself in a good mood. What song do you put on?
Oh, Kathleen by Josh Ritter.
I have no idea what that is.
I will send it to you later.
Absolutely. Okay. Kathleen by Josh Ritter. Second question. Who would you guess is a reptilian? who would you guess?
Oh, Mitch McConnell, absolutely.
Yeah, don't you think it's a little too on the nose? Like he looks reptilian.
Yeah, I know he does, but maybe they're just not good at disguising themselves.
That could be true. We don't know. He reminds me of, have you ever seen Men in Black?
Yeah.
The first one. He reminds me of like when the bug guy goes into the guy's skin, you know, in the first movie. That's who Mitch McConnell reminds me of. And he kind of talks like this. Like, that's a good call. Okay. You're on par. Okay, last one. The big question.
Uh-oh.
If only one of Shakespeare's works could exist, which one would you choose?
Mean question. I love Twelfth Night. That's the one that I have to have in my heart forever.
Goodbye, Midsummer Night's Dream. Goodbye, Romeo and Juliet. Goodbye, Macbeth.
Twelfth Night is such a beautiful play. It explores identity and gender and sexuality. It, to me, it's like it's got all of the best of Shakespeare. I will fight you on it.
Damn. No, I will not fight you. You're absolutely the expert. All right, well, thank you so much for your time, and again, like I really want the people to check out your work. Your work is so important, and thanks for talking. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. This was lovely.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.